We are making progress getting people vaccinated against COVID-19. We have good evidence that masks and social distancing reduce the risk of infection. And the drug company Pfizer says its new antiviral medication is nearly 90% effective at preventing severe symptoms of the disease. But you know what might put us all in a better position to survive the pandemic? Measures that focused on keeping all of us healthier all of the time. And many of those have nothing to do with hospitals or doctors or pharmaceuticals. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest says we need to deepen our support of public health, but also to broaden our definitions of what it means. Although many of us don't think about it, good health starts long before we come in contact with a deadly pathogen. It starts with measures to ensure decent housing, economic equality, social and racial justice. Dr. Sandro Galea is here to talk about this. He is a physician, epidemiologist, and Dean and Robert A. Knox Professor at the Boston University School of Public Health. His newest book is called The Contagion Next Time. Sandro, welcome back to Think.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Many people have wondered why SARS, which is even more lethal than COVID, was contained with just over 8,000 infections, while COVID has now killed more than 5 million people around the world. You say it comes down to luck, good luck and bad luck both.
Well, it was certainly bad luck that SARS even happened, but it's good luck that it didn't come to this country. I think we tend to forget that when things happen in other countries, SARS hit Toronto particularly hard. Obviously, it started in Asia and killed many people in Hong Kong, that it's sort of not our problem. And SARS wasn't really a problem in the United States. So we came to think of, well, it's not going to happen here. And then, of course, COVID-19 happened. And the emergence of these viruses is, I guess, bad luck, but it happens. It has happened consistently over in human history. And there's no reason to believe that it will not keep happening. We've been lucky when it hasn't hit us hard, and COVID hit us hard. And surely this is a moment when we should be paying attention and learning lessons from it.
How did the state of health in the United States make so many of us vulnerable to this disease?
I think the state of health before COVID was, if not the full story, then certainly most of the story as to what happened with COVID. And I think we can take many steps back there and start by saying, what is it that made COVID a severe disease? Well, we know this. We've known this from January, February of 2020, that what made COVID a severe disease was underlying illness, that the people who died from COVID were those who had underlying heart disease and lung disease, hypertension, diabetes, etc. In fact, one of the things that I think was not well understood was that if you didn't have any of those, your chances of dying from COVID were very low, always, right from the beginning. So then what made us vulnerable to COVID was underlying poor health. Well, we as a country have had underlying poor health for decades. We as a country live shorter, sicker lives than all our other peer high-income countries. We have more diabetes, more heart disease, more lung disease, more hypertension than these other countries. And the reason for that, of course, goes back decades and centuries because of how we have treated health, or more to the point, how we have neglected our health over this time.
Why is average life expectancy an objective way to measure the health of any given population?
So life expectancy essentially says how long we can expect to live. And you can have a life expectancy at age zero, which is what we typically mean, meaning when you're born, how long can you expect to live? Or at any age, you can have life expectancy at 50, meaning once you hit 50, how many more years can you expect to live? It's a handy shorthand measure because it's getting us a metric of length of people's lives. Of course, length of people's lives also reflects then underlying illness, because if one is more ill, one is likely to live less. Now, we as a country have about 5 years less life expectancy than other high-income countries. And this has nothing to do with COVID. This is pre-COVID. And we have been falling behind in life expectancy for the past 40 years or so. In about around 1980 to in the mid-80s, we were even with other high-income countries. But for the past 40 years, we've been falling behind. And we've been falling behind. That means we've been dying earlier. And we've been dying earlier because we've been having more and more other diseases. And between 2016, 2018, in fact, we had a downturn in life expectancy, meaning we started living less. Our life expectancy got shorter for 3 years in a row. And that was the first time we had had this year-on-year for 3 years in a row decline in life expectancy since the 1918 flu pandemic. So really, we started, our health was getting worse when COVID hit us. And in many respects, I think we were sitting ducks. We were sitting ducks for the tragedy that COVID was.
So in the United States, we focus most of our health resources on medical services. In fact, those two phrases are mostly interchangeable for people. How does our spending compare with other wealthy countries? Like, what are they spending money on that we aren't, instead of spending so much money on care from doctors and medications and that sort of thing?
Yeah, so let's start with the conflation of the two terms. I really appreciate you saying that, Chris, because you said we often mix up terms, health and healthcare. Health and healthcare are two totally different things. We as a country spend much more on health than any other high-income country, by about 30 to 40% than other high-income countries, we spend more. But in fact, what we spend is on healthcare, not on health. We have an overwhelming investment in doctors and medicine because we have come to see health as something private, something that we can buy and sell. But actually, what we can buy is healthcare, and healthcare only helps us after we have become sick. Health is not healthcare. Health is the state of not being sick to begin with. And creating health instead of a current sick care system actually means investing in what causes health, things like safe housing, good schools, livable wages, gender equity, clean air, drinkable water, fair economy. These are the conditions that actually generate health, and we underinvest in those while we spend all our money on healthcare, which is really a sick care system.
So in order to expand our thinking about what is required to expand health, you say we need empathy, which is to say, I guess, a willingness to look at this as a collective challenge rather than strictly an individual one or a set of conditions that affects everyone and not just us.
I think so. I think it's a misunderstanding of health as an individual good that puts us in this box. And what I argue about in the book is that we actually want compassion. Compassion means that I want the best health for you, Chris, because we share humanity. And I want the best health for everybody because we have shared humanity. It is a value that we should aspire to. Because once you start thinking that way, you realize that we should be investing in the conditions that can make your health better, my health better, the health of all listeners better. And that shifts us away from this notion that each of us can buy our health. Now, once you realize that we actually cannot buy our health, I would argue you realize very quickly that both the right thing to do and the smart thing to do is to invest in those conditions that generate health. And of course, a global infectious disease pandemic is the ultimate teacher that way, right? Because we've all realized that while I can maybe protect myself because I have the privilege of being able to work from home and lock myself off from seeing other people, the more people who actually are infectious with COVID-19, the more the chances are that I'm going to get COVID-19. So we realized very quickly that our health was interconnected. The truth is our health has always been interconnected. This has always been the case. But COVID-19 just made it that much more abundantly clear. And I think it should have been a clarion call for all of us to say, we should be seeing health as something that is a public good, something that we all share, and something that we are compassionate enough to want to invest in so that we can all be healthier together.
So COVID has been particularly dangerous for people with underlying health conditions, and obesity really stands out among those conditions. Before we talk about that, explain what we know about why obesity might make us more vulnerable to being very sick or dying from this virus.
Yeah, fundamentally, obesity is a risk factor for many other underlying illnesses. Obesity is a risk factor for heart disease, for lung disease, for liver disease, obesity is a risk factor for cancer. So it is probably a shared risk factor for a full range of other illnesses, all of which predispose one to severe COVID when one gets COVID. Now, of course, the question is, why do we have so much obesity? We actually have about three times more obesity than we had 30 years ago as a country. And I think we often stigmatize obesity because we say, well, it's about individuals choosing to eat more. Well, it's not like we as a country are choosing to eat more, three times more than we did 30, 40 years ago. No, what really drove the obesity epidemic in this country has been the change in the composition of our food, that we have much more food available that's calorie dense and nutrient poor and cheap. And that availability, the widespread availability, has meant that we may be eating the same way, but we actually gain much more weight. I mean, when you look at their data on this, you look at things like burgers. Like a burger today has 2.5 times more calories than it did 40 years ago. The same thing. So you as a person could say, I'm eating a burger, but 40 years ago, you would have had far fewer calories than you have today. And that then creates this risk factor, which predisposes us to all these other conditions.
I want to talk about the economy because, aside from the many ways being poor creates vulnerability to COVID-19, you acknowledge here that, like, already struggling people were most likely to be economically hurt by pandemic lockdown conditions. How could something like a universal basic income have protected more people during the height of the crisis?
Yeah, so one of the things that happened at the height of the crisis, now we're going back to 2020, more almost 18 months ago, is that as the economy was going through this turmoil of the crisis, we were trying to figure out what to do about it. And one of the things to do about it was to shut things down and encourage everybody to stay home. Well, if you were in a job which was already a low wage paying job where you could not stay home, and in fact, we know this, that it's the higher wage jobs where people are able to stay home versus lower wage jobs, you are afraid of losing your job because you otherwise had no means of supporting yourself. That means you kept going to work and you exposed yourself to COVID and you had higher risk of getting COVID. So if we had economic structures in place, and maybe universal basic income is one of those, where people had the economic resources to be able to do what's necessary to protect their health in a time of crisis, that would actually change the patterns of people all of a sudden having to work in a way that threatens their health. And I mean, the evidence on universal basic income remains to be gotten because there really are no good studies on it. But we do certainly know that employment, wages, all of them are associated with better health through these mechanisms, through accumulating assets and through being able to protect yourself from shocks like COVID.
The federal government did send support checks to most American households, but it framed these as economic supports rather than explicit public health measures. What might be different if we had explicitly acknowledged the way unemployment and economic security affect health?
I think it's an exciting approach, actually, because we need to change our collective conversation about what it is that drives health. And you're completely correct that economic support was sent out, and it's actually really painful to even imagine what the country would have been like had we not done that. And had we framed that as being directly due to our concern for health, if we frame discussions about housing as discussions that affect our health, if we frame discussions about, for example, infrastructure, transportation, as being discussions that matter to our health, we would shift our conversation towards health away from sick care or health care. And I think collectively, we'd be much more willing to support public sector moves or private sector actors that are willing to invest in our collective health. And right now, this is a challenge we have, is that this conversation you and I are having, Chris, I feel like is outside of the mainstream. We continue to see health through the lens of doctors and medicine when we need to shift the lens to see it through the lens of economy and housing and schools and education. And that is a much more accurate health lens.
Is that also true among many of your colleagues in the healthcare industry?
I think there's been a real shift and evolution understanding within health and healthcare. I think what I'm saying is certainly not at all controversial within public health. Within medicine, I think there's more and more of an awakening on this. We've actually done surveys of doctors where we ask doctors, what is it that contributes most to your health? And most doctors do understand that things like education and employment and housing and clean air and drinkable water matter more to your health than does medicine itself. So I actually do think that within people who do this for a living, this is understood. But in the general population, it remains far from where we are.
It was really interesting to me reading your book because I don't want to put words in your mouth, but in some ways you almost said medicine should be a last resort. Like, we should do all these things before we ever start to get sick or have our bodies break down. Of course, we know, you know, health problems are not necessarily evenly distributed, even among people who are living pretty well. But it's a really remarkable way to think about health. Is there a society on the planet that really thinks about health this way rather than thinking first about health equals access to a doctor?
We've actually done surveys of different countries around the world, and we know that the plurality of people, if not a majority of people everywhere, continue to think that health is being driven by doctors and medicines. But I was excited when you said what you said, because absolutely, medicine should be a last resort. I would rather never see a doctor, as I suspect so would you. And I feel like when we say that, sometimes people sort of look at you kind of funny, but forget us. Let's take a metaphor. Let's talk about our cars. mean, I would rather not spend any time with my car in the shop. I would just like my car to operate. And the fact that I have to take my car in the shop every once in a while is sort of a nuisance, and you do it. Should be the same thing with doctors and nurses, right? If we had a choice, we would never see a doctor. We'd just be healthy all the time. So in many respects, this is so commonsensical that I feel like we have missed it. And I think we've missed it for many reasons. We've missed it because of particular incentives in our system that have encouraged the growth of what sometimes is called the medical industrial complex, where really there are many incentives in the system for maintaining a stream of sickness because a lot of payment and things like that are tied to it. So it will require a real shift. And you know, one metaphor which I use in the book is the one of fire stations. And we've had firefighting in the world for thousands of years. It probably came about around the Roman Empire, because in the Roman Empire, when they were having cities, they realized they were burning down. So they created firefighting units. Now, about 50 years ago in this country, there was a recognition among firefighters that wouldn't it be better if, rather than just fighting fires, they were also part of preventing fires? So firefighters started investing in inspecting homes and partnering with municipalities on setting fire code and all that, and making sure that there are sprinklers in homes. As a result, in the past 50 years, we have dropped our number of fires by half. Now, we still have fire departments, right? Because we still need fire departments in case there is a fire. But isn't it a better world that we have far fewer fires?
So what's so interesting about that, Sandro, is that most people don't balk at the idea that some of their property tax dollars go towards supporting the fire department. Even though a fire in my house is unlikely to affect you in any way if you live across town, why don't we think that I'm at risk of being too entitled to something I didn't earn if I have access to the fire department if a fire breaks out in my kitchen? Why is that thinking so different when we apply it to the availability of other measures to support public health?
Yeah, isn't that interesting? I think that all these things come down to how we are accustomed to talking about things, and it takes time to change that conversation. You know, it means we need to treat health the way we treat parks, education, the post office, fire stations, our environment. In all of these, we see them as a piece of our global commons. And we may argue how much money to invest in the post office or not, but we accept that the post office is a shared good. We accept that fire stations are a shared good. We accept that parks are a shared good. But we are not there at accepting that about health. And we need to change the conversation to get there. And now, how does one change a conversation? I think one changes the conversation by having the conversation over and over again until we start seeing it differently. I've often reflected that a sign of success that this conversation you and I are having has penetrated, has made an impact, is when you have a election and in the primaries, you have candidates debating a particular housing initiative because of its impact on health, and saying, are we going to do this because here's the health impact? Or debating a particular transportation initiative and saying, what impact is that going to have on health? And I think when we get there, this conversation will have moved ahead much further.
Is there a way to have these conversations without it devolving into something that is entirely about politics and really not about health at all anymore?
Well, I think we are having this conversation, and we actually haven't even mentioned politics once until right now. So I do think there are ways of having this conversation because we're having it. And I think the challenge to all listeners would be to make sure that they have these conversations in their own families and their own workplaces. And not, I'm not afraid of politics being part of the conversation. I would caution us that politics does not mean partisanship. Politics does not have to mean divisiveness. I mean, politics is fundamentally the act of choosing where we invest our resources. And choosing to invest our resources in parks, education, post office, fire stations, our health, that's a political act. That is different than the kind of bitter partisan divides that we've gotten used to. And I think we've affixed politics to that. And that's really undesirable. And we need to stay away from that.
You remind us here, by the way, that although COVID took its greatest toll on the elderly, the next pandemic could be a bug that takes out children or young adults in their prime, as with the influenza pandemic. There is no reason to think the next threat will be the worst for those approaching the natural end of life.
No, not at all. In fact, as you correctly are referring to, the 1918 flu pandemic affected young people much more than the COVID pandemic did. And we really don't know what kind of pandemic we're going to have, which is why our job is to create as healthy a society for people of all ages as much as possible, because we really don't know who is going to be under threat. And I think sometimes we're too ready to say, it's not my problem. And I suppose what I'm trying to say is our health collectively is all our problem.
The wait for effective vaccines seemed really long as we were waiting, but it's really almost miraculous how quickly we, you know, had these formulations that could protect a lot of people. What we may not realize is that the research into those had been ongoing for many years before COVID came along specifically. How can we prepare for the next pandemic in terms of science and research and support for those things?
Yeah, the vaccine story is an extraordinary story, right? We developed vaccines within 8 months of COVID really becoming an issue in the US, but it wasn't just 8 months, as you correctly said. It was really decades. It was decades of investment in the mRNA technology that became the platform for these vaccines, which shows us how we can do so well when we invest in something. So what should we be doing for the next one? Well, we should be having this conversation and saying, what are our economic structures that we need to fix? What are our social structures we need to fix? What are the causes of health disparities that have consigned particular groups to having worse health for decades? And let's fix those. And let's fix them now rather than when we have the next pandemic. You know, in the book, I use this metaphor of a ship. And if you have a ship going through a storm and you have a hole in the hull, well, that's a big problem. But then you finish the storm and the ship is in calm waters and the sun is out and the hole is above the waterline. And you can say to yourself, well, it's not a big deal. The hole, we're sailing along just fine. Well, of course, that's foolish. The time to fix the ship is when you're out of the storm. And what I'm hoping and what I'm trying to do with this book is to say to us collectively, as soon as the storm is over, and we're not through the storm yet, but as soon as the storm is over, we need to redouble our effort on doing the things we need to do to repair the ship before the next storm.
So ultimately, this book is a call for compassion, right? And a recognition of our collective responsibility. You also want that compassion to extend to people whose behaviors in the pandemic might strike us as ignorant or irresponsible. You offer the story of a woman you called Jean, who just was told it might not be safe to attend church services. Some people might see that as like hard to understand why she would continue to go. You note that her choices are shaped by forces larger than herself.
I think compassion is easy, and I don't think it's really compassionate. It's just about people who are close to you, who are like you, and who you love. The whole understanding of compassion is, and compassion is different than empathy. Empathy means I care for you because I can see the world through your shoes, and I can understand your suffering because I can see myself suffering like you. Compassion says, I really can't see the world through your eyes, like I really cannot, but I care for you and your health simply because we are humans on the same planet together and we should care for one another. So compassion says we should care for people who are different than us, who think differently than us, because we are never really going to be able to understand other people. And I try to use the example of Jean to illustrate how she has a life and a history and a social context that may be totally different than yours, where for her, going to church is as essential to her being as for me might be going to work. And we don't need to understand Jean to want Jean to be well. That's the key to compassion. We don't need to understand one another to want all of us to be healthy. And one of the things about having these conversations about a book like this is I talk to people who are of all kinds, who are different than one another. It's really a privilege. And everybody I talk to wants their children to be healthy. Everybody wants their children to be healthy. It's a universal shared value. It really, in a way that very few other things are such universal shared values. And I ask myself and I ask us, can we not use that value to unite us?
What have you learned about human nature to suggest whether it makes sense to simply make vaccines readily available to everyone as opposed to compelling people to take vaccines? What's the right way to go about this?
Yeah, I'm very hesitant about the compel part because there are many reasons why people are not getting vaccines. First of all, I think the vaccines are extraordinary. As I said, they've been very efficacious. They're very safe and everybody should get a vaccine. But I also understand why there are people who have had no reason to trust the health system for decades, why it's hard then to say, trust us, these vaccines are okay. You should really get vaccinated. The time to build trust is not in a time of crisis. The time to build trust is a time when, going back to the ship metaphor, when you're not going through a storm. And it is on us, on the system, to create trust with everybody so that when a crisis happens, people are willing to get vaccinated. And I think one of the lessons we've learned, and we've learned many lessons in this time, is that in many respects, it's easier to invest and to create vaccines quickly that are effective and safe than it is to vaccinate people. Because vaccinating people depends on creating the kind of world that people trust is invested in their health. And people justifiably do not trust that the world that we're creating is one that makes them healthy, because they see with their own eyes their friends having diabetes, having hypertension, having lung disease, having heart disease, and see how their health, in fact, has gone backwards, which it has. As we discussed a few minutes ago, life expectancy was going backwards even before COVID hit. People see people dying from overdose and suicide and firearms, and they recognize that we are not really living up to our word of making the world, or at least the country in this case, a healthier place. Then to then come in and say, well, now we have the solution that was needed for health right now is the vaccine. That's a really tough pill to swallow, so to speak. So all of this, to my mind, points to the inevitability, the ineluctability of a wholesale investment in the world around us that makes us healthy, that makes people believe that we are collectively making an effort to create a healthy world, such that when there is an emergency, people will want to get vaccinated because they see that as part of a continuing story, a story of investing in people's health.
Sandro, a lot of this book is a call for all of us to reframe how we think about public health and what is encompassed by public health. I'm also wondering about our trust in public health in a situation like COVID, where everybody is sort of learning about this particular pathogen in real time. Therefore, the advice was changing. We're still trying to figure out, how the disease behaves in different kinds of people. What is a way that public health professionals can help us all to understand what it means when the advice they gave us a month ago might change?
Yes, I think public health has had a difficult time during this pandemic in many ways. And one of those ways has been that we have had a hard time saying, we don't know. We have had a hard time saying, this is what we think the answer is, but we think this right now and we may change our mind. And I think that came from a place of anxiety that in the face of a crisis, that people would not listen to uncertainty from public health. But in fact, there's science behind this that shows that people are able to understand uncertainty, and they're able to respect voices of authority who say, we do not know. So I think public health itself has a lot to learn from this moment. And I've written a bit about this, and the book refers to this as well, that, and one of those is public health needs to have the humility to recognize that often it does not know, we do not know. And it's okay to say that. It's okay to say, we do not know based on what we know. This is our best recommendation right now. But we'll come back to you, and we may change that tomorrow and the day after.
How did you learn to be comfortable embracing that kind of humility and that knowledge that you don't always have all the answers?
Well, I'm not sure I'm that comfortable. Humility is a strange thing. Once you think you have it, you've lost it. So I'm not entirely sure that I actually have it. I am trying to use the moment to push myself to think about what are the lessons that we should be learning, because COVID was just a tragedy, right? 700,000 people. That is people's mothers, fathers, uncles, aunts, lovers, cousins. These are people who have lost. It became the third leading cause of death in 2020, and nothing redeems such a tragedy. But I think the tragedy is deepened if we don't learn from it. If we do not learn from it, we are not respecting the lives lost. So I suppose I've been trying really hard to think about what should we be learning? What should I be learning from the moment?
Do you think we're emerging from the pandemic?
I think we will emerge from the pandemic. I do think we're emerging from the pandemic slowly. The pandemic, the COVID is not going to go away. It will become endemic, which means it will have some baseline rate that we will learn to live with. There will be some pattern of booster shots every so often that we will all adapt and we'll move on with our lives. So I think we will emerge from COVID, and I just want us to emerge from it stronger.
You said you wanted 2021 to be the year when you were more hopeful. What gives you hope right now?
Conversations like this give me hope. And what I mean by that is the very fact we're having this conversation gives me hope, because if we did not have this conversation, then these ideas would stay unexplored. And the fact that there are listeners who are listening to this conversation gives me hope. I can't help but feel like I'm not the only one who has this impulse to want to learn from this moment. I think that's a shared universal desire to learn from this moment. So that gives me hope that we can actually have this as a teachable moment where we learn things that we should have learned decades ago, but it's fine that we're learning now and that we will use to create a better country, healthier country.
Dr. Sandro Galea is a physician, epidemiologist, and dean and Robert A. Knox professor at the Boston University School of Public Health. His newest book is called The Contagion Next Time. Sandro, thank you very much for making time to talk with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. We would love for you to be subscribers to the Think podcast. It's available for free wherever you get podcasts. You just search for KERA Think, subscribe, and leave us a review if you've got an extra 2 seconds. You can also listen whenever you like at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.